Welcome to the Right to Reason podcast. I'm your host, Robert Stanley. Today, we are learning about the hierarchical structure of systemic racism.
It's the Right to Reason podcast.
The anger that's being seen here is not new. When you hit the National Housing Act of 1964 and actually enshrining redlining into the mortgage practices, to talk about Black Wall Street up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, how that was bombed and destroyed. Not only was that serving to help white Americans or those of European descent, you know that they are better, but also it pushed a narrative to those of African descent, African Americans in this country, that they were less than.
I think there's about 20 to 25% of the people out there who thrive on black, white, good, bad, and they're driving this evangelical Christian stuff. And they're driving white supremacy because it feels really good to be on top. And they're going to fight every inch of the way.
Fundamentalism impairs or impedes our ability to think critically. And white supremacy is a form of fundamentalism or fundamentalist thinking.
I was nervous having all these guys around with guns in a completely peaceful protest. So the next day I'm at the gas station, I talked to the cashier, and I was telling him about how creepy this was, and I hear from behind me this guy go, "Yeah, I was one of them." And I'm like, "Don't turn around, Robert, don't turn around, like you're going to get in an argument."
That initiates my fight or flight. At that point, I think that if I don't do something, these people are going to kill or harm me.
This episode of the Right to Reason podcast is brought to you by our patrons and contributors like me. We have all recognized the value of the unrestrained marketplace of ideas and have decided to make a difference. You can make a difference too. Contribute at patreon.com/right and learn more about your right to reason at therighttoreason.com. Your activism is appreciated.
The coordinator for Austin Atheists Helping the Homeless, and he serves on the board of directors for Freethinkers Association of Central Texas, Recovering from Religion, and Foundation Beyond Belief, Phil Session. A registered professional counselor in Canada, developed the Divorcing Religion Workshop, and director of the Conference on Religious Trauma, Janice Selby. And this one I'm going to do from memory. And of course, our old friend, Dr. Daryl Ray. He's a psychologist, founder of Recovering from Religion and the Secular Therapy Project. And you, the former, secular sexuality, you started that, and then Atheist Experience picked that up, didn't they?
Yep, they sure do. They're doing a great job with it, too.
Also, author of multiple books, The God Virus. this is straight memory here. Bear with, what was this? That was the first
sex,
one.
Sex and God.
Sex and God. Yes. Right. Yes. Right. I'm so happy to have all you guys.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Phil, you brought a motley crew together today, I'll just tell you that.
Phil, I gotta apologize to you. I talk about you more often than you would likely know, just because you're
there.
Good stuff. But you're one of the few folks from this movement, from this community, that I've had the privilege to actually meet. And it was last episode in my closing, I said the co-host of Atheist Experience is going to be on our next episode, and I didn't know that you're a former co-host. Would that be fair to say?
Yes. So my last episode was last June. So it was June of 2019, where it was me and Don there. And then I did Godless Bitches a little bit later on. That it was another podcast there at the ACA. It was my last portion on. Beyond that, I've been just guest starring. Good night. Just guest co-hosting.
Guest stars fair.
To be clear, on different podcasts. So I was on Seth's podcast a little earlier this year with the Thinking Atheist, along with other African Americans in the secular movement, talking about several different issues, particularly as it pertains to representation of African Americans in the secular community. That was one of the main topics that we kind of drove at.
I was hoping to talk to you guys about hierarchies today. It's almost like it's toxic in its marketing perspective, because right-wing people, religious people, they hear this and they you know, the Jordan Peterson alarm goes off in their head, you know, and they start thinking, "Oh, we're talking about how horrible white cis males are and that everything's our fault and whatnot." My day job is a quality engineer. So everything that I do through the community or through the podcast, I tend to look at a lot of these kind of topics from a job perspective, you know, and hierarchies are super important in the workplace. I had like a short 1 minute clip I want to play for you guys and get your opinion on it, if that's okay.
Okay, sure.
Of course it's not working.
Okay, here we go. Where's the quality part of that?
Yeah, quality, right?
I mean, if it's a silent clip, then I would say that's probably
it's the video. Best quality I've that's heard. It's a silent film. All right, let me try again. Here we go.
Hierarchy versus equality. Hierarchical cultures. People believe that society is vertical. So in hierarchical cultures, we value age, status, titles, qualifications. In equality-based cultures, we believe society is horizontal. Therefore, we look at squashing. Titles are not a big thing. I may be the CEO of a company. A new person joining in will call me by their first name. No problems at all. Okay. We had a client, actually, who was a young, high potential who went to Thailand. Thailand is a very hierarchical society from Australia. Very smart person. Obviously, he was very used to calling everybody by their first names and went to Bangkok and was calling everybody by their first names. And they wondered why he was getting no traction and no help, because that behavior was considered rude. Why are business cards so important in certain cultures? In hierarchical cultures, your business card tells me a lot about you. Your status, where you fit in the structure, and how I should speak to you.
That made me think about what I do in my workplace is I'm always pushing the ISO quality perspective of continual improvement. And I think whenever we're talking to the other side, you know what I mean? The right-wing side or the religious side, that we start talking about hierarchies in our culture, they push back a little, but I think what they don't get is they think, oh, you atheist liberals, you want to tear down everything that's been successful in Western civilization. You want to tear down everything about America. You don't want to make America great again. You know? But what they don't get is we're trying to continually improve. And whenever we start talking about problems with systemic racism or with sexual oppression or with patriarchy and many of the other topics that are hierarchical, we're just trying to make things better and more equal for everyone. Would you say that's fair?
I would have to agree with that. I mean, especially in the U.S., a lot of what we see on TV, a lot of what we glorify, I suppose, is very much on that status-based portion. This person, you know, this ball player, or they own this much, they have this much wealth, and there's so much celebration. And so that's kind of the easy hierarchy to kind of see as people are working to aspire to be like that. When you get into some of the other hierarchies, you know, such as, you know, the racial inequity, you know, some things are obvious and other things are not. And it starts to become a struggle of trying to help people to understand that these types of hierarchies actually exist, even if they make you uncomfortable. And so I think in a way it is trying to better ourselves by even having the conversation in the first place and getting people to understand this is where it's coming from. You may not have noticed this, but it was still affecting you all this time, that mm-hmm. type of thing, and trying to really get people to bring it to the forefront, even if, like I said before, it makes them uncomfortable to even consider that they might be affected by these particular hierarchy structures. You know, they're sitting within it and they never knew it, or if they did, they didn't really care, or it wasn't on the forefront of their mind. But bringing it to the forefront so you can actually address it is a challenge in and of itself.
As a white woman, you know, 50 years old, my experience mainly, the one I can relate to, is hierarchy as it relates to patriarchy and the church. So as I'm watching everything that's going on in the United States right now and around the world too with the protests, I really have been largely quiet as I've been watching it and trying to figure out where I fit in with all of this and what I need to become aware of in my own life, because it's like if you're a fish swimming in water, you don't even really recognize all that's going on around you. You just feel like everything is a normal way.
I think every hierarchy has baked into it a structure of beliefs and ideas and ideologies that it just is baked right into whatever that hierarchy is. Mm-hmm. Once you're inside of that hierarchy, it's hard to see how that affects your individual behavior. it doesn't feel abnormal to behave a certain way because everybody else is behaving that way.
The wife was making fun of me. We went to the Black Lives Matter protest last weekend, and as soon as we left, she's like, great, so I get to hear that you went to the protest for the next 6 episodes in a row. That's going to be fun. It's like, but it's a current event. I want to talk about it. But one thing that came up that I thought was really fascinating is when I get there, it's totally peaceful, right? But there's all these boogaloo dudes, you know, those guys, like they got like the camouflage pants, but like a Hawaiian shirt or something. They all got these AR-15s. There had to have been 50 of these guys around the protesters, not concerning themselves with the cops and whether the cops are going to become violent, but making sure the protesters, I thought, the way I took it, were intimidated, right? I was very, I don't want to use the word offended. I was nervous having all these guys around with guns at a completely peaceful protest. So the next day I'm at the gas station, I talk to the cashier, and I was telling him about how creepy this was, and I hear from behind me this guy go, yeah, I was one of them. And I'm like, don't turn around, Robert. Don't turn around. Like, you're going to get in an argument. This is not. But I turn around, I look at him, and it's just this old guy. He's there with his grandkids, you know? And I immediately thought, like, okay, this is not the environment to, like, get in an argument or something. I just politely asked, like, why were you guys there? We didn't need you there, you know? It wasn't necessary. And he says the local businesses contacted us and asked us. They're called OCT, Open Carry Texas, but they're part of that whole Boogaloo thing, right? And he says they called us to show up to protect the businesses in the area, and they gave that they were the ones that had all the tables and all the water bottles. And I was like, oh my god! Like, it hit me immediately. That whole place was like surrounded by tables that were set up there with water bottles for everybody because it was a hot day. And I thought that was the BLM movement. I didn't think that was part of the, you know, the Boogaloo people, right? So I like, and I thought, wait a minute. So this was local business. Like, I was very comfortable with pointing my finger at those people, the Second Amendment people, and being like, you're the bad people, right? But really, it was the businesses in the area, and it hit me like, this is not, it's not easy black and white. That's probably not the best colloquialism to use, but it almost applies. But it's not simple good guy, bad guy stuff. This is kind of systemic.
It's not as on the surface as what a lot of people would like. Like, we like easy distinctions. People love to be able to, you know, pick a hero, pick a villain, and make it very easy. And there is a lot of gray area on that side. So in one instance, so just this morning, as a matter of fact, we went out in Austin to hand out supplies, food, and toiletries to those experiencing homelessness in the downtown Austin area. One of the places that we go, our main location, actually takes place in front of the police station itself. So as you can imagine, a lot of the protests have centered around that particular spot. So I took some pictures today of some of the graffiti that was put on. There was No Justice, No Peace painted on the wall of the police station, their little icon that actually shows their name and everything. It was painted right there on the front of the police station. But one of these happenings, this was on in last week, I believe, there was a gentleman who was experiencing homelessness that had his belongings burned. And this took place right in front of the police station. As soon as I saw the video, before I saw anything else, I knew exactly where it was, because this was the place that we go every month for the last 10 years. And so recognizing the man himself that was there was also, you know, kind of that gut punch that was there. And we went to go visit him just today, but his stuff was being burned by people that didn't seem like they were a part of the protest at all, that seemed like they were just adjuncts, just on the side. As he was dragging his mattress away from being burned, one of the gentlemen came and dragged it back onto the fire. Like, the video was infuriating, and my goodness. And so in those cases, it's much more straightforward to say that this is, you know, everyone was feeling for the gentleman who was homeless. His name is Kale, and they got him, you know, GoFundMe's were started. He has a new mattress. He has a new tent, which we saw today, set up at that same corner. And I won't say the corner just for his own purposes, but he was doing okay. And it made it very clear as to who was, you know, on the side of right and wrong in that situation. But you know, when it comes to business owners and other people that are there to support, it's kind of hard to tell at sometimes when somebody is on the side of the protesters or are they there just to agitate. You know, it starts to be unclear until you start to see some actions that are there, which, you know, makes things a lot more confusing. But I always say to people online or wherever else to not lose focus of the actual reason that was there, because even with everything that goes on and all of the outrage, I'm still focused on that. You know, millions around the U.S. and now over the world, since there's other protests happening internationally, are focused on that central premise of injustice that's happened, that we've witnessed for so long. But I don't want to get on a soapbox too early.
But no, please do.
Before, because I can feel myself chomping at the bit.
It's spooky. It's really spooky because all these bricks that seem to be showing up in places, like I'm not some conspiracy theory or something, but what the hell? That's not normal.
Yeah, that was one. I saw it online, and there was somebody that took a video of it, and the person in the video, like, they didn't want to discuss where it was, but I recognized the building. So I grew up just outside of Dallas. The building that they were in front of, it was right by the courthouse, the George A. Allen courthouse, to be specific, a big white marbleous structure that's in the downtown Dallas area. And all of a sudden, here's this random pallet of bricks just randomly here on the corner. Like, this is a very well-developed area. Like, it's very set. And so it was very weird. And people in the video, this is on Twitter, I believe it was originally posted, they were just like, what are these bricks doing here? Like, what are these even doing here? There's no construction around here. Mm-hmm. You know, like, how could these have gotten there? And it just brings up those questions of, you know, who sat this here? You know, what in the world? How did these even get here? Who, you know, no one saw this actually happen. It was just, it's very interesting. You know, I don't go into conspiracy theory too much, but it was definitely something that rubbed me the wrong way of being at a corner of a finished courthouse that's been established there for, you know, it's been there decades. I'm not sure how old that building is, but it's been there a long time. Good night. So what in the world are these doing here?
Were they a gift from Vladimir Putin?
Yeah.
Well, who benefits? Who benefits from things turning into a riot, from things getting crazy?
I'm not into conspiracy stuff either, Phil. I'm not trying to push that. But let's just remember that Hitler had the chancellery burned down and blamed it on the communists.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's a very old trick. And you could have fascists or whoever you want to call them, right-wing people, bringing that shit in, basically handing an excuse to someone to start something so they can then crack down through military or police, whatever. Who knows?
Exactly.
Janice, you're up there in Canada. Did you see the video of the guy in Minneapolis that was smashing windows before the protest? And apparently it was a police officer. I don't know if that's been confirmed or not.
Oh, wow. No, I haven't
seen
that video.
Did you guys see that?
Yeah, sounds horrible.
Did you see that, Phil? Where he had an umbrella and he was all covered up. And like the actual people that were there protesting were like, what are you doing, bro? Get out of here. And he had spray painted on the wall free stuff inside. The video doesn't show him spray painting, but you do see white paint on his hand. And you see in his pocket kind of the shape of like a spray can. And it's very suspicious. And he threatens to attack the person that's following him if he doesn't leave him alone. And then they let him walk off and he tries to like hide, like go through like the little alcove area, like the dumpster area, you know, behind a, it was like a O'Reilly's auto parts or something, and then disappears in the parking lot. But they took that face thanks to, you know, the internet, which sometimes good, sometimes bad. And maybe this isn't necessarily accurate, this next part, but they took that face, and it's the same face of a cop in St. Paul, just north of Minneapolis. And that's where that guy, I can't remember his name, Castillo. I think it was Castillo, the guy that was—he was just reaching for his wallet, and that nervous young cop shot him.
Oh dear!
That's one that disclosed ahead of time that he was a concealed carry individual, just to alleviate concerns. Right. You know,
what the fuck? Where's the NRA with this thing? I thought they were all about, you know, people's rights and standing up to the government. That's why they need their guns. But you don't hear shit from them right now.
They were mysteriously quiet after all that. Maybe they did put something out there. I did not see something that was broadcast as loudly, because they usually can get very loud when they have something that they really want to push. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you kind of hear about it here and there. But yeah, for that instance where this a licensed individual that had a concealed carry that disclosed this to the police officer so that there was no confusion later, which I understand on that side, because you don't want to get caught and then all of a sudden he's like, oh, there's a gun in the car, and calling for backup. And there's so many bad things that can happen due to that, that it makes it's perfectly reasonable to say, hey, you know what? I have this in the car. I just want to let you know ahead of time. Cool. You know, and the officer was so, you know, scared or yelling out to not reach forward or something like that when he was reaching for his license and insurance or whatever else. And I can't even imagine the young woman who was in the front seat, who was recording on that side, just watching it, and how calm she tried to remain given those circumstances. And it was unreal on that side. But it's funny. When I first saw the story, even about George Floyd, when it appeared on my social media wall, I honestly thought it was just a rehashed story from the past, because people do that. They'll reshare old stories. And it was only after looking at it when I really got a sense. And it left me, you know, in a state of temporary disbelief, I suppose that's the best way to say it, because it was only a couple weeks ago that, you know, it blew up online and on the news here and there about the shooting of like Ahmaud Arbery, who was 25 years old. This was on February 23rd when he got shot jogging down the street.
Oh, yeah.
By individuals who were following him down there. And just a little bit after that was Breonna Taylor, who got shot down in her home while she slept, while plainclothes police were executing a no-knock warrant on a house looking for two individuals that were already in custody, no less. Like, considering that, it was no surprise that these protests sparked off the way they did, and the rage and the exhaustion and the notion of being fed up with this current system. But the anger that's being seen here is not new. It should not be new to anyone. Like, that goes all the way back to when, you know, this nation was first getting together in the first place, you know, back in the 1600 in Virginia, where they were enshrining racial laws into the land and really beating it into people's psyches that this is the way that it should be, that this was God ordained, that this separation should happen, that it is this structure, this hierarchy that exists, that has white people and one people, or people of European descent on one level, and then everyone else as beneath them. And even when you got to the Civil War, and you know, the Civil War ends and, okay, happy day, and slavery is no longer legal, so to speak. But the ending of that war and the fact that the North won that war did not change the hundreds of years of laws and anecdotes and the quote unquote common sense that many white Americans had, that people of color, particularly those of African descent, this is also including like Native Americans in that as well, because they were also a part of that. But the belief that these folks were beneath them, less intelligent, less capable, and that was coming straight from their creator. Like, that was the story that was there, and that's what was cemented way back then. And so as you get into the Jim Crow laws that happened post the Civil War, about literacy tests, poll taxes, grandfather clauses, you know, everyone knows kind of those signs that say, you know, the white fountain versus colored fountain, colored waiting rooms, stuff like that. And those pictures still exist, but that's been going on for so long. And people, like, I guess people are not really honing in on the fact that not only was that serving to keep people separated and segregated on that side, but that also helped to reemphasize in people's psyche, like, for people that are white, that even if you're poor, you're still better than this colored person over here that can't eat in the same place you do, that can't order their food at the same place you do, even if they're allowed to order at all, versus having to go to the back to place, you know, that food order. It's a long-standing systemic thing, and it rolled right into laws. It kept being codified into laws, such as when you hit the National Housing Act of 1964 and actually enshrining redlining into the mortgage practices that happened in this country, because that recovery was there's so much going on and home ownership was booming, and now you had this federal programming ready to help back these mortgages. And of course, when you have a home, when you can build that wealth, you can pass that wealth to your children, you can take out loans against that property you now own. But in Austin, for example, I-35, the big I-35 that rolls right through the downtown area, was used as one of those redlining portions where the east side of 35 was redlined as an undesirable district to invest, while the west side, which is where the main downtown building structures and everything else, that was the side that was really pushed. And so even when you go to Austin now, there's a lot of development that's happening both east and west of 35, but you can still see a stark difference because the east side is just now tearing down buildings and starting to build up new things, because on that side, that was the poorer side, that was the minority tagged side. And they couldn't build that wealth. They couldn't take part in the generational wealth boom that was happening leading up because of these systemic, not only from person to person, but also in a de jure faction coming directly from the law that this is the way we're going to apply these things. Because even back then, I'm sorry, I'm just going on so long. I apologize. But okay. Here we go.
Keep going. We're all listening.
Even when I worked in commercial real estate, and I remember reviewing deeds, there was one deed to a house, and I think this was done in the 1930s, where one of the clauses in the deed itself is that you cannot, and upon buying this property, you have this property and all its faults therein, you cannot sell this to a colored person.
No.
Oh my God.
That's in the deed?
In the deed itself, as one of the clauses that you are subject to as the purchaser of this property, you cannot sell this to an individual of color. And that was par for the course. And this was a deed out of Dallas County in particular, which, you know, a lot of people look at it as like, you know, this is a large urban area, so there's a lot of African American folks, but this deed was still in place right there to make sure that that owner never sold it to an African American and limited the mobility and options that African Americans had altogether to get their own real estate in the first place and start benefiting from that boom of wealth that came from home ownership and what you can turn that into as generations go down the line. It just exacerbated the huge minority, the gap in income and wealth for these families. And so, you know, when you get to these more current events and people will question you, if you say, you know, there is systemic racism in our society, well, I don't see it. You know, can you point it out to me, et cetera, et cetera. But it may not be as in your face as like that deed clause was. That was a very frank and in your face. This is what it was. And of course, they had no fear of putting that in there because in their minds, that was the right thing to do. That was just fine and par for the course for that time. But even now, so going to the example of, say, Amy Cooper, which was a recent case out of Central Park in New York, where she had her dog that was unleashed in a park that required that leash to be there, and was approached by Christian Cooper to say, hey, you know, you have to put your leash on in this area. And a back and forth ensued. And during that particular exchange, she said, quote, I'm going to call the police and say an African-American man threatened my life.
Oh my God.
Now, this is already while Christian was actually recording on his phone at that point in time. So that part was also there. But that phrase indicates and shows that she is very comfortable and is cognizant of the position that she holds in this hierarchy. Right. She is very aware that that threat is actually a threat, that if she, as a white woman, calls the police and specifies that an African-American male is threatening her life, which she proceeded to do afterwards, getting louder and a bit more distressed in how she was communicating that quote unquote threat to the police over the phone, being recorded the whole time, of course. But she knew exactly where she landed in that hierarchy. She knew whether she made a conscious decision to say, this is what I'm going to do, or if it was an unconscious bias to say, this is what I know of the system, so I'm going to say this in an effort to get this gentleman to black off. It also means that she relied on him knowing his place in the hierarchy to know that if she calls the police, his life may possibly be in danger. If she calls it in and say that he, as an African-American man, is threatening her, a white woman, in this society.
The irony is not lost on me that that gentleman's name is Christian.
Yeah.
Because obviously we can't ignore the way that racism and Christianity, and particularly evangelicalism, but how they all have their roots together in America. And I did want to actually make a recommendation to your listeners. I just started following someone on Twitter, and he's just phenomenal. It's at J. Wyatt Sexton. His name is Jared Sexton. He's a political analyst, and he just does a magnificent job of explaining the roots of all that together, how it's come up through America and how it is absolutely impacting society today. And so I really want people to give at J. Wyatt Sexton a follow. I'm learning a lot from him.
And I'll also, on that same note, I will also suggest a documentary. It's called Holy Hierarchy, The Yes. Religious Roots of Racism in America.
Yes.
And it's included with Amazon Prime. No extra money needed. If you have Prime, you can just go watch that portion. But it also hits more. It was good enough. I wanted more of it.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, I wanted them to explore more, to go to talk about Black Wall Street up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, how that was bombed and destroyed by individual, and how it was referred to Little Africa and Niggertown by people that wanted to denigrate the fact that these African-American peoples had built this thing, that built this, these airports and these shops and banks and businesses, and had this land that was there and had been developing it for decades. By the time in 1921, when that event occurred, I wish that was also explored, because that's not something that we were taught in school. That was never in any of our history. Like, it didn't matter what level I was in, that part was not covered as a part of that learning. And so I definitely recommend that, the Holy Hierarchy, The Religious Roots of Racism in America. It was directed by Jeremiah Camara. I believe that's how you say.
Camara.
I apologize. Mm-hmm. And even Dr. Daryl Ray is also featured in there. He has some excerpts that are thrown in there. But it's a nice take at that historical vantage point of how these things were enshrined and how they still have an effect on today's world. And in Amy Cooper's case, that was one, you know, it kind of brought it to the forefront, even if she didn't realize it. She was a part of that hierarchy and relying on it to make mm-hmm. that statement.
Mm-hmm.
And also when it came to Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick, Georgia, that was hunted down by the McMichaels riding in their trucks along. But just picture that in your mind. If you're jogging along and several vehicles, not just one, but several began following you, and a slow enough, I mean, you're only jogging. How fast can you go, really? You know, I don't know everyone's speed, but no, I'm not that fast. And to notice that you're being followed by several vehicles and then starting to get yelled at by people in those vehicles wanting to talk or whatever they said, enough to where they got out of the car as Ahmaud tried to run and jog around them and was encountered by individuals with weaponry. Not police, but regular people. That illustrates to me that the McMichaels, the folks that were following this young man, this 25-year-old man, as he was jogging down the street, they did not consider what they would look like to this individual. They did not consider how it would look if several people armed to the teeth were following this individual and then got out to confront him. Because me, myself, if I'm presented with that situation, I don't know what your intention is. I don't know what you're planning to do. All I see is there's multiple people, you've been following me, and now you're out of the car and I can see firearms in your hands. To me, that initiates my fight or flight. At that point, I think that if I don't do something, these people are going to kill or harm me.
Yes.
It's an obvious thing to me. It's not like they were getting out and saying, well, hey, neighbor, how are you? Welcome to the neighborhood. Just want to talk to you about something that's going, nothing like that. Like right. It appears that they meant to harm him. And so what else could he possibly think? And so, of course, the struggle ensues and he is shot and dies there on the street from that. And the McMichaels were saying that, oh, well, there was some recent activity in the neighborhood. We were just trying to police. But the fact that they did not even have to consider how they appeared to someone else, if they approach someone in this way, it didn't even dawn on them how that would come across. And of course, how a reasonable person would react to seeing them in this armed state, actually coming directly at them with these arms in hand, yelling, not talking in a calm state. Like, what else are you supposed to think? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't in their purview. They didn't have to think about it. They weren't worried. It just wasn't there. And that's, like, once again, for me, shows a bit of that system that's in place, that these individuals, the McMichaels, did not even consider that or even think they had to.
It's horrifying.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
That's the thing that scares the hell out of me, that they're just the tip of the proverbial iceberg, and it's a gigantic iceberg at that. Mm-hmm. There's so many people who just feel the privilege is theirs, and nobody can question that, and they've got the right to literally be impervious to their behavior against someone else. They obviously, as you said, Phil, they obviously did not feel there was any consequence or anything wrong, fundamentally wrong, with what they were doing. It's mind-boggling. What would be more interesting, I think, is going back to Jim Crow era even, is how will they go about being convicted? And if they are, will they get a sentence that's commensurate with first-degree murder? I mean, I'm guessing they're going to have a hard time finding a jury. It's not the first time getting a jury to convict somebody on an obvious murder. Now, you turn the tables around and let two black guys hunt down a white guy, you can bet they're going to get the book thrown at them, mm-hmm. among other things. It's just the justice system is still incredibly, incredibly unjust in this. Mm-hmm. And it's not just in the South. We saw it in Minneapolis. I mean, it doesn't matter. Yeah. We used to think it's just the South that does this. But no, it's everywhere. It's fucking everywhere.
It is everywhere. And Canada's not immune to this either. We have our own horrible problems with discrimination here. And certainly most famously against our First Nations and Indigenous peoples, but also certainly with Black people. Yeah, it's really a horrible problem, and it does exist everywhere.
Did Canada have slaves like the U.S. did?
If we did, I think it would have been to quite a lesser degree. I can't say that we for sure did, but I don't think it took off nearly as much here.
Britain outlawed slavery around 1820 totally, and actually started persecuting and prosecuting the slave trade to eliminate it from the Western Hemisphere. Now, you can argue about why they did it and all that, but basically England was no longer participating in the slave trade, and its subsidiary colonies mm-hmm. were not supposed to be either. And I don't think Canada was ever a part of it, even though Jamaica, of course, and Caribbean islands still were.
Yeah, I feel certain that there must have been some people, some Canadian households that did have slaves. But I think it was quite a small number. Dr. It's despicable Ray, no matter how the number is.
Dr. Ray, is there something about the brain or just from a psychological perspective that could help us understand where racism comes from, at least? I've heard from evolutionary psychologists that it's all about avoiding germs, virus avoidance. If somebody that looks different from you coming to your tribe, that they might have a virus that infects you, and that somehow our brains just got wired for it. That to me, like, I feel like while that's satisfying on the individual level, it doesn't really explain the systemic level that we're referring to now.
No, it sure doesn't. There's two different levels, I think. And one is the systemic level, which I read a book decades ago. I don't recommend the book necessarily, but the title of the book I thought was an interesting angle. And the book's title was called A Crack in the Cosmic Egg. A Crack in the Cosmic Egg. And his thesis was, we all live in an egg. There's nobody. Everybody lives in a bubble. We call it a bubble, but he was calling it an egg. We all live in this bubble or this egg. And every now and then something comes along that will put a crack in that egg. And from that crack, you can see that there's a world outside of that egg. And you can't repair it. You can't put it back the way it was. From then on, the crack gets bigger and bigger, and the world expands. Whether you like it or not, it's going to expand. We're kind of in that situation right now, I think, where, and it happens every now and then, maybe as a result of something, some event, external or internal, that we're forced to acknowledge a new crack. And I, for years, for decades, people have been discussing, sociologists have been discussing, psychologists, everybody's been discussing systemic racism, systemic issues within our society. And the cracks have been there for a long, long time, as Phil's already illustrated. But now the crack is so wide, it cannot be ignored. So that's the systemic part of it. And the political system and the social system is starting to have to come to grips with the fact that millions of people are marching down the street and asking, well, why would they want to do that? That even the most conservative person still got to come to grips with that. So the crack is there. We can't ignore it. And it's, you can't stop it. And you can't go back to the way it was. Hopefully we'll see some change. The other side is there's a spectrum of personality characteristics, and those interact with the way the society interacts. And that's why you can have kids raised in a super conservative family or maybe super religious family, and yet one or two of those kids will leave and become atheists, or one of those two kids will leave and become and be liberal in their outlook. It's a personality component that's probably got a literally has a genetic component to it. And I'm not saying everything is genetics, but I am saying we have a lot of genetics in our personality. And some personalities really need rigid, really thrive on or really desire, or really seek out deeply structured, right, wrong, good, bad, black, white. They love it. And the nuances just go above their head. They can't deal with nuance. Mm-hmm. Those two guys that murdered Ahmad, those two guys that murdered him had a structure in their brain that said whites are good, blacks are bad, whites are on top, blacks are on bottom. I mean, they had this really black and white. Now, I don't know these two guys, and I'm just guessing, but I've seen too many of these people that there's no nuance. The world is this way, and if you don't agree with me, you're a bad guy. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. There's about 20 to 25% of the population anywhere on the planet that has that belief structure, but it comes from their personality. Now, if you don't believe that genetics have a hell of a lot to do with personality, you can just look at dog breeds. And if I say German Shepherd, anybody that knows dogs can tell me what kind of personality that dog has. Or Dachshund, you can tell me what kind of personality. Well, they don't get it. They don't learn it. They're born with it. That Dachshund's born with that personality, and the German Shepherd's born. Well, humans have got the same DNA, and we're born with the same personality variables. And so what I'm saying is I think there's about 20 to 25% of the people out there who thrive on black, white, good, bad, and they're driving this evangelical Christian stuff, and they're driving white supremacy because it feels really good to be on top. And they're going to fight every inch of the way. They're not going to go down fighting easily. They're the ones that still want to keep the Confederate flag out. They're the ones that want to keep recognition of Robert E. Lee and a statue in Virginia. I mean, they're upset about that because that upsets their black and white world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a definite intersectionality with Christian nationalism and white supremacy, for sure. And then I also think fundamentalism impairs or impedes our ability to think critically, and white supremacy is a form of fundamentalism or fundamentalist thinking. So then if they already have this bent in their genetics, like Doctor was talking about, and then they are also surrounded and in this echo chamber of people who are constantly repeating that and feeding them those views back to them, it's very hard to break free from the grip of that fundamentalist thinking.
Phil, so I got a story I talked about in the last episode, but I wanted to ask your opinion about this in particular, because honestly, this is a topic I don't get. Anytime I'm having a conversation with somebody from the right, they'll bring up, yeah, but we've got black people too, or black people also voted for Trump, or white people voted for Obama, or what have you. While I get it, like, let's not pull the race card about everything, I understand. But anytime I'm trying to make a point about racism, they seem to bring this up. And what really brought it home for me was at this recent protest, one of these guys standing there with his AR-15, almost circling. Like, it wasn't like they made like a circle, but they had like groups set up, particularly, you know, 360 around this group of people protesting. One of these guys is this black guy, and I walk up to him and I'm asking him, what are you doing here? You're not keeping an eye on the cops. You're keeping an eye on all the black people. And he got furious. He looks at me, he goes, I'm black. And he walks off, and I think, like, he's got a point. Maybe it's not direct racism, but maybe within the concept of systemic racism, a black man could still be promoting an agenda that is not intentionally racist, but inherently racist?
When I was talking about some of the old laws, like even going into the Jim Crow era, laws like the poll tax and grandfather clause and the separate but equal type water fountains or whatever else, as I said before, not only was that serving to help white Americans or those of European descent, you know that they are better, but also it pushed a narrative to those of African descent, African Americans in this country, that they were less than. And so I don't doubt that same systemic issue that's been propagated for years over years, whether, you know, by word of mouth, by a particular news outlet, through laws that are pushed, through differing sentences that are carried out, you know, whatever level you want to go on, I don't doubt that it will affect someone who's also black themselves. And so, you know, it doesn't have to be something like of comedic over the top. Like if y'all have watched the Boondocks, there's a character in there that was very over the top in this way, an African-American who didn't like African-Americans per se and was like just very over the top about his racial tones. And it was meant to be that comedic side. But, you know, in real life, and even with this gentleman, I don't know this gentleman personally or whatever else, but there's nothing to say that he himself, even though he's an African-American, he may believe that himself to say, oh, well, African-Americans, you know, they commit more crime because, you know, I saw on this news program, I watch this news outlet that says this is what they do and this is what this group is about. I know I'm not like that, but these other folks are not me, and they might be a part of this group that was fed to him. Just like I said, depending on your outlet, your news outlets, how you're taking in information over time, like you may develop a bias yourself, even if that bias is against people who look just like you. Like, it's not an unheard of notion to have. I mean, and the only thing I could say for that gentleman is to actually stop and start thinking about what his preconceived notions are, to actually take that introspective look of how he arrived at this conclusion that it was reasonable for him to go out into the streets with this gun in order to watch, you know, certain people or whatever he was doing out there. But doing that makes people uncomfortable. When you talk to white Americans about the state of affairs in certain instances, that makes them uncomfortable. You know, it makes you defensive or whatever else. And so it's not unreasonable that it may affect this gentleman as well, depending on where he got his biases and how he's allowing them to manifest in his actions, as culminated in this, you know, being at the protests, kind of standing over to the side with this AR-15, you know, ready to do something. What that is kind of unclear, so I won't make a judgment on that. But to me, it doesn't seem unreasonable that he may be subject to the same biases that get laid down, depending on how honest he's willing to be with himself about how he got those biases in the first place.
Well, obviously, nobody here thinks that we should hate black people or hate white people, but we all hate Canadians. Can we at least find some agreement on that?
Hey.
Oh, sorry.
No, I'm sorry.
You're okay. No, you're sorry. I was going to say, you went the whole episode. You didn't say sorry once, but there we go. Thanks, guys, so much. Janice Selby, Dr. Daryl Ray, Phil Session. The listener can find all of their content links in today's show notes. I'm really grateful for this conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you to Janice, Phil, and Daryl. Thank you to Dave Blair at DaveBlairMusic.com. Thank you to our patrons. You can support this broadcast at patreon.com/write and learn more at therighttoreason.com. Next week, a white male racist congressional candidate will be debating the topic of Black Lives Matter with Tiffany Harding, a black woman comedian. I'm anticipating it to be some mixture of infuriating and hilarious, but I'll be honest with you, I'm feeling a little anxiety about this one. Make sure you don't miss it by subscribing to The Right to Reason on your podcast outlet, or if you're hearing this on YouTube, be sure to hit the bell. Black Lives Matter debate next week. Between now and then, remember that you have the right to reason.
It's a Sunday afternoon when my neighbor starts shooting his AK-47 out in his backyard.
You got one of those?
Oh, my God.
I am not shitting you. I don't... He's got a target range in his backyard. He invites all his best friends over, and they all start shooting. Scare the shit out of you. Don't know what's going on. I mean, literally, the house next door to me is where that's going on.
You will not call the police if we hear gunfire.
Right. No. Not this time. Not if it's Sunday afternoon. That's when we shoot people legitimately.
That's when you just start doing that, what was that, naked gardening? I saw you do a couple times.
Yeah, right.
That's
right.
When you pay him back. Like, all right, I got my rights too, Jack.
Barb's favorite day of the whole year is naked gardening day. Although she does almost no gardening. I do all the gardening. She just wants to get her picture. She wants to make it a photo op, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that Barb.